Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM. And all that is now, and all that is gone, and all that's to come, and everything under the sun is in view, and the sun is eclipsed by the moon.
Hello and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John.
And good evening to you, Ben, and hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone, indeed. As ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. And you can catch us live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and also as a podcast. Now it's going to Artemis and more Artemis. Unless you've been hiding under a rock for the past week, you'll know that three men, one woman, have gone to the moon, the far side, and swung back, and they're on their way back home. And I was watching a lot of it live on NASA TV. Especially last night, wasn't it, when they swung around the back of the moon?
Mm-hmm.
And so are you, John. You stayed up later than me, did you not?
I did. I most certainly did. I saw the start of the flyby around the back, and the screen went blank for 43 minutes and a bit. They said around 40 minutes, and they were spot on about that. So we'll talk about that in just a few moments' time, because it is Artemis. Yes, indeed. Right, this week's planet roundup: Mercury, Mars, Saturn and Neptune. Not so good for looking. They're deep in the glare of sunrise at the moment. Mercury is the brightest and the least low. It's the only one of them that you might have a chance of seeing at all. And all week it stays at magnitude zero, which is quite dim, and about the same altitude. So if you want to try it with binoculars, just a few degrees above the horizontal, a little to the right of due east, about 25 minutes before sunrise. So good luck with that one if you can get
good
there.
Good luck with that, indeed.
Indeed. Venus, on the other hand, bright at magnitude minus 3.9. It's getting brighter. It's really
can't
good.
Miss it,
yeah,
now.
No, you can't.
Assuming the sky is clear, of course.
Yeah, I saw it the other night. We've had a couple of good nights over the last week or so. And it gleams low in the western evening twilight, a little bit higher each week. So 50 minutes after sunset, find it about a fist at arm's length, 10 degrees above the horizontal. And it sets soon after the end of twilight. Jupiter, a little bit dimmer, magnitude minus 2.1, but still a fine sight because it's very high in the sky. It's the second brightest, only to Venus. And it shines nearly overhead when you face southwest at nightfall. And I've been watching that for the last goodness knows how long. So later in the evening, Jupiter swings lower towards the west and it sets at around 2 or 3 a.m. depending where you are. Daylight saving time, of course. And in a telescope, Jupiter is down to 39 arc seconds wide. It's
getting smaller.
It's shrinking and fading as the Earth pulls farther ahead of it in our faster orbit, of course, around the Sun. It's interesting in the way that this retrograde motion for Mars and all the rest of them, we sort of zoom at our different, speeds through the space, and it takes about 2 years for Mars, so we will catch up, pass it out, and it looks as if Mars is going backwards for a while, so that's a retrograde. So interesting to read all about that type of stuff as well. Uranus, the last one, magnitude 5.8, it's in Taurus, and it's just south of the Pleiades cluster and still some 30 degrees high in the west at the beginning, at the end of twilight. And a high power telescope is what you will need for that one. It's a little tiny but non-stellar dot. And to help you along, you'll need a detailed finder chart to identify it amongst similar-looking faint stars. You could get to see it if you have a good telescope to see it with as well. So that's good. The International Space Station, not really talking about it much at the moment.
No.
it's sort of in the background a bit. Anyway, it's not in our evening skies again until May the 8th, until May the 22nd, so it's a good time for that as well. So we'll keep you informed as to some of the times during the weeks passing May the 8th until the end of May to make sure that you have a good view of the International Space Station.
Thank you, John, for that. Of course, we also have the moon and the sun. And at the moment, we have a 72% waning gibbous moon. Currently, it is, yes, is it not above our horizon? And it's actually, no, it's not at the moment, actually, I should say. But it will rise in the early hours of tomorrow morning at just after 3 a.m. And when it's due south and at its highest at 6:03 tomorrow, it'll be a down just slightly smaller 68% phase. And when it sets at sometime later, I think it's a few hours later, I think it's after 9, it'll be a 67% phase. So we're heading, of course, towards the third quarter moon, which will be on Friday the 10th. Now, the sun rises tomorrow in Dublin. That's Wednesday the 8th of April at 6:42 a.m., which is 16 minutes earlier than a week ago. And the local or solar noon in Dublin, that's when the sun is at its highest and due south. That's at 1:26 p.m. And the sun sets at 12 minutes past 8 in the evening, a whole 12 minutes later than a week ago. And then we have various degrees of twilight until astronomical twilight ends and nighttime begins officially at 10:23 p.m. The old stretch in the evenings is quite nice now, and those twilight times are getting longer and longer. Of course, when we get to the near the summer solstice, there'll be astronomical twilight for most of the night. We won't get officially any nighttime. More of that anon, perhaps. So tomorrow we'll have 4 minutes and 10 seconds more daylight than today, and that means there'll be 29 minutes more daylight than a week ago, when there'll be 13 hours and 31 minutes between sunrise and sunset in Dublin. John.
You and I were lucky enough to watch Gemini missions and Apollo missions and this, that, the other. We're just...
Well, I don't remember the Gemini mission.
No, but we were definitely short pants jobs. Yeah, and Apollo 8, I suppose, was the first one that we saw, and then 9, 10, 11 is the one that sticks with me because I was only a little fella then as well. But it's great. A lot of people have not had the chance to see that because they were born way after 1969.
And, yes, apparently, is it something like 85% of the population of the world now, people alive now, have no experience of people going to the moon. They wouldn't even have a vague memory. Of course, if you're under this Artemis II mission now, is the first manned mission in 53 years almost. So if you're under 53 years of age, then it was before you were born. And that's basically most of the people on the planet. So
crazy. Yeah, absolutely crazy. No.
But all going well on the Artemis II mission?
Yeah.
Perhaps you can tell us, John, you're doing a bit of work on the four people on board.
On board.
All I can tell you is three men, one woman, one of the men is a Canadian. So that's the first Canadian to go as far as the moon. And, of course, and he's this is his first mission. And, of course, the woman, she's the first woman to go as far as the moon. And what else can I tell you about them?
I can tell you loads about them.
You can tell me? Okay, you fill me in then.
We go for the four that they're actually on the way back now. They're in quiet mode, although lots of things to do. So we had Reed Wiseman. We have Victor Jade Lover Jr.
The pilot.
We have Christina Cook, which it's pronounced Cook. It's spelled K-O-C-H, but it's actually pronounced Cook. And the Canadian Jeremy Hansen. So I'll just go through quickly who they are, really, I suppose, because we know that they are and have been up in space before. Reed Wiseman, he's a 27-year-old Navy veteran. He's a pilot, a father, an engineer, and a Baltimore native. So he was selected as an astronaut in 2009, in June 2009, to be exact, as one of the nine members of the 20th NASA astronaut class. And Reed reported to the Johnson Space Center in August 2009. So that's a few years back. So he's well experienced in that. There's loads to read on these guys. And it's well worth just slipping Google, let your fingers do the Googling. And Victor Jade Lover Jr., he was selected as an astronaut in 2013. And he was serving as a legislative fellow in the United States Senate. So there you are. There's a different thing altogether. And he most recently served as a pilot of the Crew 1 Dragon spacecraft named Resilience. These are all names that you and I have been through for years and years of this this thing as well. His experience, he was one of 8 members in the 21st NASA astronaut class. And after completing astronaut candidate training in 2015, he served as a space station capsule communicator, known as CAPCOM, and in the Expedition 52. He was an operations officer and family escort for several Soyuz and Crew Dragon launches. One of the most challenging, of course, and rewarding jobs, indeed, as an astronaut. So, again, loads of reading to do about this. Christina Cook now as well. She is one interesting lady as well. She's an explorer, an engineer who became an astronaut also in 2013. She's been assigned as mission specialist of NASA's Artemis II mission. Her previous experience in spaceflight was living and working on the ISS, that's the space station, for almost all of 2019 in expeditions 59, 60 and 61. Isn't it remarkable? And for this mission, she flew on the Russian Soyuz rocket and trained extensively in Russia. And she spent a total, which we sometimes don't realize, 328 consecutive days on the International Space Station, which is night. And she participated in the NASA Academy program in 2001 and worked as an electrical engineer early in her career. She was selected, as I say, in 2013 as one of the 8 members of the 21st NASA astronaut class and completed astronaut candidate training in 2015 and 2018 when she got her first space flight, which was a long duration mission to the ISS. Do you imagine what the training must have been like to do that? Because I've watched these type of things, and if you fail one little thing, like claustrophobia maybe, something like that, when you're inside the spacesuit or something like that, or when you're in that big swimming pool in the spacesuit, or even the dunking that you get as if when the helicopter goes over and upside down, etc. If you fail any of those, you sort of reduce.
Or your survival course, underwater or out in the desert or the jungle. Or.
I went to see Tim Peake when he was doing all that sort of stuff when he was up in the space station. He was going through all that sort of stuff, and survival is one of the biggest things. And when you're out there, if you're seen sort of arguing or fighting with any of your comrades, you're off the list. You know, it just doesn't. There's no room in there for little bickering stints. You know, so you have to be a particular type of person.
You have to be a particular character, and because when you consider these people up in the Artemis, the Orion capsule, which is about the size of the inside of, size-wise, it reminds me of the inside of, you know, those old Volkswagen Beetle vans.
Yeah, exactly.
It's something like that. Mm-hmm. And if you're with 3 other people, and you have to spend 10 days in that environment, you have to be of the right kind of personality, character to get on with people that you don't have rows, because there's nowhere to go. You can't go out for a walk to cool down.
Mm-hmm. And then the last one, of course, the Canadian. It's the first time he's been into this type of environment, I suppose. He is Jeremy Hansen. And they all seem to get on very well together when we looked at what was going on as well. And he was, of course, the first Canadian to ever venture to the moon. He was born on the 27th of January, 1976. It's only a young fella. He wasn't around for Neil Armstrong on the moon, exactly. He's gas, isn't it? Loads of career highlights. And he's married with 3 children. Of course, he loves sailboat cruising and racing and rock climbing, mountain biking, of course, being an astronaut as well. Again, loads to see about him as well. And I'm sure we'll hear much more about them as time goes on.
Thank you, John. You're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. And we are available on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and also as a podcast. And our text and watch number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. We have a text in from Aaron. It's actually about a song. I've got the sun in the morning. Do you know that song?
No,
I don't know it. The one I've been thinking of all week was actually George. You know, George Harrison has a song called "Here Comes
the Sun."
Yes, here comes. But there's also has one called "Here Comes the Moon."
Is it?
comes the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. No, not quite as good as Here Comes the Sun, but that's the one I've been thinking about. Now, back to what they've been doing up there. Do you know, John, one of the most common questions asked by astronauts, astronauts are asked is, how do you go to the toilet in space? It's always a big one. And speaking of which, speaking of toilets, it's the, as far as I know, it's the only thing they had trouble with as they were. They had a blocked loo. But everything, Christina got out the space plunger and imagined unblock it. So,
that's where her engineering training came into. Cleaning.
So, a 150 Mr. Price plunger, but it was a $23 million toilet. That's what it, that's how much the cost of designing and building, making that loo was. Because it has to work in, of course, zero gravity. Mm-hmm. So I presume it's like a normal toilet, probably a bit smaller, but, and there would be a bit of a suction pull, vacuum on it so that the waste material goes in the right direction and doesn't flow about. But they had trouble with the loo, but Christina went off and
she did fixed it.
And but they still had they had a bit of trouble as well. They were complaining about a smell from it, but it wasn't what you normally get a smell from a toilet. They said it was just like a heater that you know did you ever turn on one of those heaters that hasn't been used in months and you get that smell of kind of burning dust. Mm-hmm. But but that was okay. Mission control, of course, told them, no, that's okay. It's maybe just some outgassing from some of the materials that it's made of.
When you look
$23 million, I'd be looking for my money back.
Yeah, you've seen it, the pictures of it, and you can see it on the internet, of course, as well. But it just looks a bit of pipe and a couple of bends here and there. So what's inside it? Who knows? You know, it's. And I was trying to figure out exactly where it was on the capsule itself. Now it's down at the bottom where you have to get down into it, and it's beside two radiation shelters as well, which are two storage lockers, just in case they get a blast of radiation from the sun while they're up there. And they are advised to go inside into the radiation chambers, if you like. So just to give you a little idea of what is in Artemis, you know, the capsule, because a lot of us would see it at the top of the rocket. We would never, ever get a chance to see it unless you're over seeing the first version of it in one of the exhibition centres that they have in there. So the Artemis itself is 11 feet tall. Now, most of us work in feet and millimetres. 16.5 feet wide, which is roughly 5 metres. 316 cubic feet of living space. And that's not a lot for four people to be in. Whereas the Apollo was only 12 feet wide, so it's a little bit extra. And the extra few feet here and there makes an awful lot of difference. And the difference between Apollo and Artemis, they have a galley, a water dispenser, a food warmer to rehydrate meals, and we were shown that as well. If you've been watching it, they had shrimp and all sorts of things that they had to pour water in and just rehydrated everything. And Christina said it tastes a-okay, it's not too bad. There's a service module just behind the capsule itself, and a wing comes out for the solar panels, and it's to help power the spacecraft, and it holds the engine propellant as well, as they want to just twist it in a different direction just to adjust maneuvers. And the heat shield itself is designed for 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit and a speed of Mach 32. Now, Mach 32, multiply that by 600, whatever it is, the speed of sound, and that's quite quick as well. So that's over 25,000 miles per hour. Three parachutes are on board to slow the descent for the safe splashdown as well in the Pacific.
Planned for Friday off the coast of California?
Friday into about midnight our time here on Friday night into Saturday, yeah. Yeah, so not a lot of us know an awful lot about the Artemis. So there's a couple of things that are inside it. I'm going to go even further than that, see if I can get a blueprint. See if I can get that somewhere to see exactly.
Build your own.
Well, you never know. Yeah. Lego.
I thought you were planning on being the first Irishman
no,
in space.
So. No.
Or to the moon. No. Okay. And they did go, the other thing of note, of course, is that they did go further from the Earth than any other people have ever gone before.
Yep.
Up to that, the record was by the Apollo 13 crew. You remember that ill-fated mission where they just managed to get back. But they went something like 246, somewhere around there, 1,000 miles. But this Artemis 2 crew have gone 252,756. Statute miles.
There you go, or 406,771 kilometers, which is further than any human has gone out into space. So it's
and when they were behind the moon, of course, the moon occulted the sun, so they had their own solar eclipse. And there are photographs. I can't wait to see. A lot of them haven't been released yet, but I can't wait to see some of those photographs, close-ups of the moon, parts we wouldn't normally see from Earth, because the same face of the moon is always turned towards us. And also but I did see one there of the eclipse, and you can see three of the planets off to one side.
That's right, yeah.
Mercury, it's really strange. Or was it Mercury? Not sure. Earth, Jupiter, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And of course, their total solar eclipse lasted 53 minutes.
Isn't it?
Which is the longest total solar eclipse if anywhere on Earth that is possible is about 7.5 minutes.
Yeah.
But then again, that's because the relative sizes and distances of the moon and the sun. The one in Spain, this year in August, is only the longest part of it is only going to be 1 minute and 30 seconds or thereabouts.
Yeah.
But the one next year will be about 6.5 minutes. Again, depending on where you are on the path of totality, but 53 minutes must be nice. Of course, they were very close to the moon. The moon would appear much bigger in there.
Yeah.
And there, from where they are, whereas us down on here on Earth, the moon and the sun always look about the same size, about a half a degree across. And the moon is 400 times smaller than the sun, but 400 times nearer. So there's just that happy coincidence when the moon crosses in front of the sun here, they're exactly the same size, and you get that beautiful total solar eclipse, and you can see the corona, the sun. It's absolutely an amazing sight. I definitely recommend it, John.
Wouldn't it be great?
They have Spain, August 12th. You can do it.
One never knows.
Mm-hmm.
They have quite a lot of cameras on board as well for taking photographs. And I think it's about 42 different types of cameras for taking different colour temperatures.
Yeah, they even have their iPhones as well as fancy stuff.
iPhones, I mean, the iPhones are as good as anything nowadays. But they have one of the cameras that they have has an 80mm lens, and the other has a 400mm lens. And they took it in teams of two to look out the window and take photographs. So they reckon they took probably 1,000 photographs through the cameras, plus all the rest of them that are there. And if it was me, and you and I are into photography as well, we would have taken much more. Just think, and then look at them later, you know, forget to look outside.
Well, you want to make sure you have, if you're going to take 1,000 photographs of the moon, you can't go back and...
No.
If we go outside and take a few photographs of them, around here in Smithfield.
Yeah.
Isn't that lousy? We come back tomorrow and take a few more. But you have to make it right. That was very well a plan to have. Like, everything is planned down to the nth degree. Mm-hmm. Who was going to window one, who was going to window two, and then they would swap, and who was going to be handing out ready with the extra, the memory cards, and who was going to use what camera, with what lens, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And you see, before I noticed, when I was watching it live as well, they would dim the cabin lights, so there'd be less reflection off the glass. And also, they had some system for defogging, demisting the glass as well.
And they had,
because if you ever taken a photograph through a glass, it can be tough enough. And you can get kind of dodgy. Well, and of course, most glass, and even in a spaceship like that, wouldn't be a great optical quality.
No.
Well, it's more designed to just keep the vacuum intact rather than optical quality, but maybe they probably a decent optical quality in those because they knew they were going to be taking photographs through it.
Yeah, they had to block out the sun at one stage because it was coming directly in through one of the windows. So they had to have to put a pair of socks up there or something just to block out a little bit of light to stop it being too bright inside because that sun is bright. So they say, and they said they could see a lot of stars as well.
Yeah, an astronaut I was talking to, I can't remember his name now. I think it was a British astronaut. It wasn't Tim Peake. Pierce, I can't remember his name for the moment, but he was saying that, yeah, you can look towards the sun, you can see the sun, and then you look around, and you can see the stars as well.
Yeah. That must be
but of course, the thing about here, of course, on Earth with the atmosphere is that the light is scattered, well, not all the light, but the blue light is scattered. The blue light from the sun is scattered throughout the atmosphere, which is why the sky appears blue.
Exactly.
Mind it bounces around up there before it hits your eye from all corners of the sky. So
I
sky
love to blue. See the thin blue line just around the outside of the atmosphere.
Oh, the atmosphere,
it's just fantastic to see that. So anyway, just where are we with time? We're sort of marching on very quickly. Just want to give you a quick overview of the route taken to the moon and back. Now, they're on the way back, as we know. And this happened very quickly. It's like a blink of an eye. They took off last week. Just after, is it half 11, was it? Half 12, our time here.
I can't even remember what day it was.
That's
now.
What I mean. It's just a day or two ago, that's, as far as we're concerned. And suddenly,
6 days ago, was it?
And suddenly they're, last night they went around the moon. They were 4,000 kilometers away from the, or 4,000 miles away from the surface. So they got a good view of the whole area and, rather than the Apollo missions when they were much closer in, they got a segmented view of things. So it's there were reasons for this as well. And it's a complex figure eight path. Now, if you followed it, I have as well, known as a free return trajectory to save fuel. It uses the gravity from the Earth to guide the spacecraft using minimal fuel for the return journey. So there wasn't much fuel involved in that. So they made their last... I suppose jet to get them in on on Thursday, and that was them. They just go around the moon, they're slingshotted around, if that's a correct word, and then they're coming back to the planet here with unaided virtually, except for the odd maneuver every now and again.
I think they had to make a slight correction mid-course, but all that, as the maths are all done so far in advance, and we know the distances between the two bodies, the Earth and the Moon, and the mass and therefore the gravitational force and the speeds at which they're travelling relative to one another. And you're aiming for a moving target, because it took them about 4 days to go there, so they didn't head straight towards the moon. It's like running at, like shooting at a deer, say, a running deer. Maybe that's a bad example, but you know, you got to track them and
yeah, they went around the Earth about 2.5 times before just hitting the button just at the correct time for the expulsion, where they've got to go from 17,500 miles an hour to 25 to get out of the orbit.
Yeah, and that actually reminds me of that film, Hidden Figures, about those ladies who did the computing, pen and paper.
Brilliant.
Yeah, over the days of computers, great. Looking on the NASA government website now at the moment, Artemis 2 mission elapsed time, 5 days, 20 hours, 23 minutes, 30 seconds, 31, 32, 33, etc., etc. Thank you, John, for that. That's all the time we have this evening. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for your texts. And, we've got to go now. But that's all from me, Ben Emmett, for this edition of The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. It's music all the way now until 2 a.m. here on Dublin City FM. Up next, we have Dublin's Greatest Hits, followed by Nigel Wood at 10 p.m. to midnight. He has his ear to the globe with his world music mix, and then from midnight till 2 a.m., Dave Barry's mix of jazz, blues, and soul in a program called After Hours. But please join myself and John at the same time, 7:30 p.m. next week. We'll be back with all the latest news from all corners and dimensions of the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening, and say good night, John.
Good night, John.
Good night, John. And all that is now. Everything under the sun is true, but the sun
broadcasting on 103.2. This is Dublin City FM.